Hey, and welcome to FutureThinkers.org, a podcast about the evolution of technology, society, and consciousness. I'm Mike Gilliland.
And I'm Yuvia Ivanova. If you're new to the show and you want to get a list of our favorite books, popular episodes, and to join our community, go to futurethinkers.org/start. Today, our guest is Pia Mancini. She's a political scientist and activist from Argentina. She's the co-founder of Democracy Earth and Open Collective, and she spent most of her career focusing on upgrading democracy for the modern world.
Today, we're going to talk about how democracy can function better in the age of the internet, the return of the city-state, self-sovereign identity, the pros and cons of liquid democracy, how to enable large-scale cooperation, and more.
All Future Thinkers episodes are now on video. To watch the premiere of each episode and join the discussion live, subscribe to our YouTube channel at futurethinkers.org/YouTube.
This episode is brought to you by Qualia, a nootropic supplement that helps support mental performance and mood. To get 10% off, use the code FUTURE at checkout. And to learn more about neurohacking, visit futurethinkers.org/neuro.
Pia, welcome. It's good to have you. You're one of our first guests to come on the show and do video with us. So we're excited to try this out. Hopefully the experiment does not go wrong, but we'll see. So I'm familiar with you for a couple of years now. I saw your TED talk and the whole 500-year-old technology. I might be getting that wrong, but that was inspirational. And I was like, we have to get her on. And then 2 years went by and we just haven't had the chance. So welcome. And I'm excited to talk about some of these subjects.
Thank you.
So why don't we start? You can just give our audience a bit of a background of, you know, who you are and what you do.
So I'm Pia Mancini. I was born and raised in Argentina. I now live in the United States. And I do a bunch of things. My two kind of main, I have three main projects that which I'm fully dedicated to. The first one is my daughter, Roma. She's about to turn three. The second one is Open Collective. It's I'm CEO of a company that supports communities around the world. We help them. We give them with a financial mechanism and an organizational structure to raise funds. So it's very much geared to supporting what we understand is a new kind of economic unity in the world that we call Open Collective. And it's essentially communities that because they're distributed around the world or because they're communities of people that come together with a shared purpose, but they don't necessarily want to create a structure around that, even less a command and control kind of hierarchical structure that is, you know, what our system understands a corporation should be, whether it's for-profit or non-profit, but that's kind of the type of organization that we have. And so we support them. We give them a way to receive money without them needing to create a legal entity that has nothing to do with how they operate and who they are in the world. We support a lot of open source projects. So open source is our kind of our main, if you want, community. Because open source software clearly is just people doing coming together and doing technology. And it's very, there's no organizational structure around it. There's not an LLC. There's no president of an open source project. It's like asking who's the president of the internet, right? It's like ridiculous. And so most of our public digital infrastructure is completely under-supported. And so we find a way of sustaining it. Happy to go more into detail later. And then the other project that I'm dedicated to is Democracy Earth. It's a foundation, and we work with, I chair the foundation, but I'm not in the kind of day-to-day operations anymore. But we work with digital democracy, kind of rethinking democracy, again, for the type of society and the type of institutions, the type of technology, the type of socioeconomic context that we have today. And so we do a lot of experimenting with that. We've been going around for several years. It started in Buenos Aires, and now it's a global project. Both of those things I'm super proud to be involved in.
Cool. So why don't we kind of jump back and talk a bit about what sort of launched you into the public sphere with your TED talk. Maybe you can give us the background on why you believe democracy is outdated and what aspects of democracy need to be updated.
Yeah, sure. So that was like a bit of a, it was a journey, right, for me. So I've always been involved in politics ever since like I was very, very, very young. Out of school, I was already involved in politics. I was very interested in that. I studied political science. My house was like a very opinionated household. And I grew up in an environment where politics was like, you know, part of our daily conversations. And so I was always very involved in that space. And I was also involved from an understanding that I was very lucky. I was born in a family that could support me. And so I felt like I wanted to give something back. And the way I found of giving something back was like getting involved in politics. And I did that from many different aspects. I did it from like more traditional think tanks, doing kind of leadership training. I did it from campaigns. I did a fair bit of campaign managing. I worked for government. And after all of that, I started the NET party, so the political party that I used to run with in Buenos Aires. And, you know, I co-founded this political party with a group of friends, and we were all very not disenfranchised, because we were all very involved, but we were all very disillusioned with the political system, and mainly with one concrete aspect of our political system, that we felt that it wasn't giving us the opportunities to participate that we wanted. And the reason why we thought that was happening was because it was a political system that was designed for a different society, right? It was our political system, our representative democracies were born in a society with a completely different communication technology. There was a printing press, right? In a time where obviously it was impossible to bring everyone together in the same room, because you needed to, I don't know, walk for, or, you know, go on a horse, horse ride for like, I don't know, miles in order to go to that place where the decisions were being made. So it made sense that at the time, at least one form of a system where the few made decisions in the name of the many was created, right? There's a whole other aspect of how a different system with the same kind of premise could have been created. But the one that we have is the one that was created is the one that we have. And so we felt that society was changing, that obviously new communication technologies were enabling us to represent ourselves in whole new spheres. We are, you know, creating a society where everyone had a voice and a way to express themselves. And our political system insisting on us only voting once every couple of years, right? And that was the level of input that we had. And anything else, anything extra that we wanted, implied us having to go through like super traditional ways of getting involved, right? So creating a political party or joining a political party. And kind of, you know, working up the ranks until maybe one day you get to, you know, say something or sit down at the table where decisions are being made, right? Public hearings were, you know, are done in person on a Tuesday at 11 o'clock in the morning. The whole legislation, so the jargon that the political corporation uses is designed to exclude. It's very difficult to understand or to comprehend, you know, a piece of legislation. And it's because it's done for lawyers by lawyers, right? And so everyone else is expected to kind of withdraw to their private sphere and kind of make money, essentially. And then once in a while, we are called to kind of say yay or nay to a government. And we felt that was very poor. And then we felt that the result was that the system was producing kind of either silence in the sense of people not voting, not wanting to engage anymore with a political system that just wasn't up to their expectations. And at the same time, a lot of noise, right? If you can't, if the channels of engagement and participation are not the ones that you want to use, then your only other option is making noise in order to be heard. And we felt that both these things weren't healthy for the political system. And so what we decided to do, this was 6 years ago. So again, the ecosystem was very different. What we decided to do was to kind of hack the system in a way, right? We decided to create a political party in with everything that a political party is supposed to do, but made decisions in a different way, right? So we created a software that was called Democracy OS, and where we invited citizens to vote on how their representatives should vote, and we kind of had the commitment of voting in Congress according to that. And kind of that experience was kind of the experience that led me to, TED in Buenos Aires in the first place, and then global, the kind of TED talk that I did. And that kind of leveled up the project and took it to like a much more, global, to a much more global space. And we started seeing Democracy OS used by different people in different countries, in different languages. And so there was clearly an emergent at the time, I think, of the type of problem that we were kind of shedding, putting the spotlight on. That's the beginning of it all, I guess.
What are some of the interesting things that you found through this experiment? Because you guys have been running the software for a couple of years now. Do you find that people actually want to participate? Like, are they motivated?
Yeah, I think that we find that they are. They're very motivated to participate. I think there's a feeling that it's up to us to change the things that we don't see, that we don't like. Look, when I started talking about Democracy Earth and then Democracy Earth and everything that I was doing, at first I got this like from whoever I was sharing this with, this sense of panic, like, well, are we going to decide, or worse, are they going to be able to decide? Like, there was like this kind of absolute lack of trust in ourselves. And then I think that still happens, right? But I think that the last couple of years, there was a shift in, it's my gut feeling, but I perceive that there's a shift in how people relate to the things that I'm saying or the projects that we implement. I think that there's a bigger sense of ownership of what's going on and what's happening in the world. I didn't feel that before, to be honest. I didn't feel that was the case. There was, when we started, I guess there was this kind of understanding that those in power were in power for a reason, and it was up to them to make things better. And if they didn't, it was up to us to scream, but it was never up to us to articulate an alternative. And right, and I think that that's shifting at the moment. And now when I speak, I find that people relate much more to this idea of power vacuums and what happens when you undermine the existing political institutions, but you do not create anything else instead. And so what happens is obviously it's Trump, it's Orban, it's Erdogan, it's Bolsonaro. Like that's the result of like an absolute lack of trust in a system, but no alternative. And so trust doesn't really disappear from society. We just put it somewhere else, right? And so when we stop trusting our existing kind of political institutions or traditional organizations, then we need to move that trust somewhere else. And we are putting it in these kind of populist demagogue leaders that are popping up. And I guess that the what happened in Egypt also in the Arab world after the Arab Spring, and in Egypt with the Muslim Brotherhood and then the military was very sobering for us to write, because it was very clear that creating power vacuums might throw us in a worse place than where we are at. And so how we can really kind of create those alternatives, kind of articulate a narrative that at least provide some sense of where we're going, of what we want. And I'm again, this is my gut feeling, but my sense is that has been changing lately.
I agree with you, actually. I've noticed the same thing. And I think that the erosion of trust in traditional political systems is a big part of why people are kind of panicking and saying, okay, well, how can we do it better? Because before, at least on the surface, it seemed like in the Western world, things were kind of running somewhat smoothly. And now, you know, with Trump being elected and all these, the Brazilian president that you also mentioned being elected a couple of days ago, who is extremely far right, for those who don't really know. And, you know, these people were elected through the traditional electoral system legally, and somehow they still got to a position of power. So people are looking around saying, okay, something is wrong. How did this happen? And how can we make it better? So what are some of your ideas about how the current democratic system can be upgraded in practical terms?
Yeah, so the proposal that we have, so we evolved our thought in the past, I would say, 2 to 3 years, from thinking how can we tinker with the existing political system and how we can upgrade that, to how can we create an alternative and start experimenting in new jurisdictions, in what are like the sandboxes of political innovation, where we can create new institutions, new democratic institutions, and experiment with that. And the reason why we did this focus, this kind of shift, is when we started and when I started my political career, I really thought that we could change the existing system, that we could rewire the existing system. And I guess that the big wall that I hit was power. There's just no incentives for existing status quo to devolve power, right? Like to stop being the status quo. And power is conservative. Like the nature of power is conservative. Those in power want to stay in power. So it's very difficult unless you produce enough stress and a pressure on the system, unlivable levels of stress and pressure on the system, to make it worthwhile for them to devolve power. And we're seeing it in the United States. Every year there's increasing levels of voter suppression, for example, right? There is absolutely no, I find it that it's very difficult for those in power to change and to accept changes. And the current system, the way the current system is built, we need the status quo to be able to change the status quo. And so that's not to say that there aren't amazing things that can be done to open up spaces for civic engagement. And there are many experiments around the world. One of my favorite experiments, and I love this, is the citizen juries that South Australia is experimenting with. There are randomly selected groups of citizens that inform policy in South Australia. And so it's the same concept as jury, like a judiciary jury duty, but for policy. What I like about this in particular is the idea of randomly selected representatives, or in this case, or citizens. The idea of randomly selected governments is fascinating to me. And the reason is that, you think about it this way, if you have a system that it's only concerned about those professional citizens that are representatives, right? And everyone else is expected to kind of withdraw to their own private lives. Then we are always going to have like this situation where it's in the system's best interest to just have to be concerned with only those in power, right? But if suddenly you change that and anyone can be in power, even if with limitations and with a short period of time and whatever, right? But you suddenly, the entire system needs to kind of shift gears toward how we make sure that everyone can participate, right? If you have like deliberative democracy processes, like you need to start, the system needs to start thinking how we can inform every citizen, how can we educate? How can we make sure that every citizen has access to, expert information that is digestible in a way that it's understandable, et cetera. So like the idea of having randomly selected governments kind of completely changes the nature of the system and the incentives that the system has. And so I really like that experiment, and I think that it can be, I'm looking at it closely, and I think that it's something that can be exported to other places. I think that the most interesting experiments in participatory politics are happening at a local level. So the city of Madrid, the city of Barcelona has really interesting participatory democracy projects where citizens are not only doing participatory budgeting, but it's something that's been happening for many, many years in Brazil and around the world. It's something that we should absolutely get every government to do, like allocate a chunk of their budget and let citizens decide how to spend that money. And again, that is clearly it's a process that makes, it suddenly makes the flow of information, the trustworthiness of the information, the access to that information, primordial thing of the system, right? Which is not the case if only 200 people are making that decision and not everyone else. So those are a couple of things that I'm very interested in, and I'm fostering, and I'd like to see kind of growing in the world. Also, I think that something very easy that could be done in at least in the United States is like moving voting day from a Tuesday to a Sunday. You vote on a Tuesday during, working hours, right? That's crazy. And so moving from that and moving away from an opt-in system to an opt-out system. Now you need to opt in to vote, and it's really difficult. And that's how all of the voter suppression is done, by kind of raising the bar for people to register to vote, obviously. Like the latest example is the Native American communities, that they've been wiped out of the voting records because they have a PO box, because they live in native lands, and so they don't have a proper address, and now they stopped accepting PO boxes as addresses to register folks to vote. It was concretely done with the idea of preventing this community to vote. So those are things that everyone who has an state issue ID and is able to vote as per the Constitution should be already registered to vote, period, and they should opt out. So things like that, I think, are obviously clear. It's very much for the American context. Obviously, Argentina is different because everyone is already registered to vote and voting is mandatory. And I think voting should be mandatory. I like that kind of option. And obviously, you should be able to opt out. Clearly. Those are kind of a couple of things that can be done today, or that governments are already doing in many different countries to improve kind of the bandwidth of our democracies. And then I think that what's more interesting to me, or what we've decided to focus on, is, all right, if we need to rethink how democracy works today, how can we start a new system? What are the jurisdictions that we have today? We want to experiment with liquid democracy. Where are the spaces where we can start building liquid democracy protocols and liquid democracy institutions at a global scale? So Democracy Earth is focused on thinking about this outside of the nation state. So completely, like in a separate way. I think that obviously the internet and now crypto communities are very interesting jurisdictions that we can, on top of which we can start experimenting with new political institutions. And why I think we need to experiment is because we need to learn how to be citizens. If we haven't done it for over 2,000 years, to be fully engaged citizens of and have like absolute responsibility for the fate of our societies, it's very difficult to start and doing it from one day to the next. Like, we need to learn, and the only way of learning is it's living through them, right? It's by doing. And so what are those kind of projects again, like sandboxes where we can learn how to be citizens and fail? We need to be able to fail, and we need, we need to make mistakes, and we need to start and learn again. So Democracy Earth is now working with ERC20 token communities by providing like a governance kind of layer for them and enabling them to figure out their own governance systems, right? Just providing the building tools for that. Crypto communities are very interesting because if you think about it, the being able to have a common currency was one of the pillars on which nation states were built and were kind of created. And so now the nation states are being challenged in their monopoly of printing a currency, right? So, and a currency is not just money. A currency is a system of belief. You buy into a set of beliefs. If you buy into Bitcoin, you buy into certain economic assumptions, you buy into certain environmental assumptions, you buy into social assumptions, you buy into Ethereum, if you buy into Zcash, right? So you are not just getting a currency, you're getting like a vision of the world, of how you understand society. If you buy into a universal basic income currency, then you clearly have a certain vision of the world. And so that's why I think those are kind of ideal spaces to experiment with liquid democracy. And then, so that's kind of on the level of the stack on top of the nation state. And then below the nation state, the level of the stack that we are very bullish about is obviously cities. Like we are seeing this almost, and this is a bit provocative, but almost like going back to a city-state kind of world, right? Because I think nation states they're not going to disappear. Obviously, they're not going to disappear tomorrow. They're being challenged left, right, and center. And they're being challenged by both things, I think, by corporations. Like Facebook wants to give you an identity, right, more than the nation state. Today, Facebook or Google own and manage more data than any state. Right, so the nation states are being challenged in these kind of from these different kind of angles: cryptocurrencies, data, identity. They're being challenged as the only sovereign actor in the world, even if this is just a minor kind of first step. But when the United States pulled out of the Paris Accord, of the climate change accord, there was this parallel pledge that was created by a network of cities, academia, governments, corporations. And they said, like, you know, fuck this. We don't care if the United States, like, as a construct, decides to pull out. We're still going to abide by it, right? So suddenly you have this situation for the first time where the nation states might not be the only kind of sovereign actor or only actor that kind of organizes power as we understood it until now. So those are all like macro trends that I'm seeing. And I think that this is going to go, you know, in two ways. It's going to go up above the nation state and it's going to go down to the cities. And I think that this trend is only going to grow as we see distributed generation of energy. It makes sense that nation states have the power that they have because they need to support also a lot of extractive energy, which is very resource intensive, et cetera. As that kind of fades into a distributed generation of energy model, that it's going to happen eventually. And cities are going to have a lot more power than they have than now. And cities are a great space to start rethinking about trust because they're much more self-contained. They're smaller spaces. And so they're more able to fail than nation states are, I think. And so because they're more able to fail, because there's like this proximity with the people that live in their space, because they're more able to innovate. So those are the two kind of like, you know, kind of big vectors that we are working on. A couple of experiments that we're running that I think are interesting. So we run this experiment with Colombian diaspora. And so there were 7 million Colombians that couldn't vote on the referendum for peace because they weren't in Colombia, which is ridiculous, right? That we still think in territorial terms for these kind of things. It just blows my mind. And so we did this parallel referendum to enable kind of the Colombian diaspora to vote. And we did it in a way that I think was smarter than the current referendums. So current referendums really kind of boil down to a yes or no question on one issue, because they're normally, they're a very blunt instrument of democracy. They're like, you know, this big massive hammer. That's what a referendum is. And so everything kind of ends up being binary around one issue. And in the case of Colombia, the referendum didn't pass, the agreement didn't pass because of this kind of issue where everything revolved around that was allowing the FARC, the guerrillas, to participate in government, right, in the future. And on the Democracy Earth kind of pilot, what we did was we worked with organizations in Colombia, and we kind of divided the referendum into a much more sophisticated conversation. And so you could kind of vote on different topics, on the different kind of issues. And so 99% of the referendum would have been approved, except the fact that, like, the Colombian referendum, the participation of FARC in government. So I think that technology enables, like, a much more sophisticated conversation. And then from there, you can also add, like, liquid democracy aspects to it. That for that, we didn't do it, but, you know, you could potentially say, okay, for these, like, 3 points of the referendum, like, I don't know about this, I'm going to delegate my vote to someone else. And so you have a richer conversation instead of just, you know, the leave or remain kind of argument in the UK, or the peace or no peace in Colombia.
Can we stick on that subject for a bit? Can you tell us a little bit more about liquid democracy? What are the upsides and downsides of it?
Yeah. So liquid democracy is a protocol for democracy that enables you to vote directly on issues or delegate your vote to someone else for that topic. And then you can take that's kind of the basic premise of it, proxy voting, right? And then you can take that to, like, any level that you want. In my mind, with the current technology that we have, you can potentially have smart contracts around that, those proxy agreements, right? So say, for example, I could say, all right, I want folks to delegate votes on me for, I don't know, a certain topic. But I know that it takes a long time for this for progress in this topic to be seen. So I'm only going to accept delegates that are willing to give me the vote for more than 2 years, you know, or things like that, right? So we lock in that proxy voting for 2 years. Or on the other hand, I say, like, look, I'm going to give you all my vote for healthcare because, you know, I trust you on that issue. But on the specific issue of, I don't know, abortion, I'm going to keep that vote for myself, right? Because I feel very passionate about it, and I want to vote on that myself. So for that topic, and all of this can be kind of arranged in a smart contract kind of way. The idea of liquid democracy is that we do not have, like, one set of people that vote on all issues for all periods, for all topics, for a very long period of time, but we have a much more sophisticated kind of bottom-up representation. So we flip representation from vertical to horizontal representation and emerging representation. And one of the, I think that the positive aspects of it is that you suddenly give power and clout, if you want, to people who are not traditional, who wouldn't be able to impact policy, right? So a doctor that works in a public hospital, right? You know, you can delegate your vote on that person. Many people can delegate a vote on that person, and that person suddenly has a lot of, like, social capital in this topic, and only in this topic, because that's the topic that they know and they feel passionate about and they have experience on. And suddenly that person has a lot of influence on a certain topic that otherwise they wouldn't be able to compete with, you know, the dollars that, I don't know, whatever, pharma pays, or, you know, the traditional lobby money. We saw that in Argentina in a little experiment that we ran. We didn't have proxy voting, but the concept is similar. What we did was there was one in Congress in the city of Buenos Aires at the time, there was just one person, one representative only from the left that was pushing for better working conditions for nurses in Buenos Aires. And nurses in Argentina, or at least in Buenos Aires, they're not a very organized group, as in they're not highly organized as in a trade union, so they do not have a lot of power. And so what we did was we kind of helped them get onto Democracy OS and start voting on this issue. And suddenly that had a lot of sway in Congress because we were able to help them organize and then push legislation through that otherwise wouldn't have been able to in the traditional game of just one person representing them, right? Suddenly they were all in Congress. So that's the kind of positive outcomes that we feel that legal democracy can bring. And then on the maybe some of the negative aspects of it, it's unclear how we're going to articulate debate. That's not specifically of legal democracy, but anyone who's rethinking democracy, it's still unclear. So there are different issues. Some of them technical, but technical issues are always less interesting, and then cultural or social issues. Because technical issues can be solved sooner or later, someone's going to solve. So on the social issues and cultural issues, so how we help structure debate in a way that it's healthy and it goes to a positive outcome where there are winners and losers, but everyone gets to participate and have a say in the way the final vote is going to go. When we started thinking about these things, social media wasn't what it is today. I think that with the experience that we have now, I would say that that's more of a problem than obviously we thought it was when we started. We obviously, when we started 6-7 years ago, there were already obviously trolls online, but I mean like the level of viciousness and division that we're seeing today in the world and the attacks that we're seeing are clearly like coordinated attacks that we're seeing. Obviously, you'd be fooled to say that we're not thinking about that or we shouldn't think about that, right? So I think everyone should be thinking about that. And then the other kind of big problem with any of the projects or experiments thinking about democracy outside of the nation state is identity, right? So how do we build a system that is resistant to civil attacks? Is absolutely so. A civil attack is when you have someone having multiple identities flooding the system. It's unclear how. So it's clear how that's solved in the early experiments that we're doing with crypto communities because there's a stake, etc. But when you scale that, it's less clear how we're gonna go solve the identity piece. There's a lot of work being done in that space. I had a really interesting conversation yesterday with Kiva, the organization. They're doing they're experimenting with self-sovereign IDs in Sierra Leone, and it's a very promising project. I was super impressed. So I mean, people are thinking about this. I think we should be thinking about this. I spend a fair bit of time in crypto conferences, and I guess my what I always urge everyone there is like, instead of thinking about how we're gonna make more money, maybe we should start thinking about how we're gonna scale this from this perspective. So how we do kind of distributed peer-to-peer identities, it's not solved yet. And so I think that's one of the major challenges. And while it's not particular of legal democracy per se, it affects it absolutely, right?
Yeah, this idea of people being able to represent themselves definitely has a lot to do with if we're going to be creating systems that give more power to individuals, then individuals kind of have to be able to represent themselves in a sovereign way. It just seems to be an important piece of that. I wanted to go back actually to one point that you talked about earlier with city-states and a return to that sort of structure. I think in addition to what you mentioned as the drivers for that kind of model becoming more likely than large country states, is also a lot of the negative pressure that is happening. For example, the climate change seems to be affecting a lot of supply chains globally, and large institutions, like countries, are just very slow to change, and they're not always able to adapt to the rapid pace of change, both in terms of innovation and in terms of just global chaos that is happening. And smaller entities might be more anti-fragile and more agile, be able to change and adapt quickly. So I wanted to ask you if you've thought about this idea of people being able to elect not just, you know, what city state or what kind of representative they have, but being able to choose the structures that affect different parts of their lives. For example, you know, healthcare from one provider, their, you know, protection like military from another provider, land ownership from another provider, et cetera, instead of just by default buying into one structure that is the nation state.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So I haven't really given it much thought, like in that, in the way you're framing it. There was a, are you familiar with the Backfit project at all? There was this project called Backfit. I think it didn't really take off, but kind of that's where they were going. Like, what public goods, if you want, can be provided by different people, and how we can build a smart contract around it, so you can buy into these kind of different services. I think it's a really interesting conversation. My kind of, you know, top of the head, or if you want, gut feeling with that is, I think we need to be like careful with the kind of privatization of some of these of these things. I think that maybe the best approach would be to come up with what's the minimum what's the minimum capabilities that we want a city to be providing their citizens? Like, what do we think we cannot live without, or folks shouldn't live without, even if, like, just for the fact that they're living in this space, this is what they get. What's the kind of minimum MVP for that, right? And then because it's just, I think that, for example, justice system is one of them, right? Like a way to, a way to kind of sift through conflict in society with known clear public laws. That's something that I don't think we should be giving up on. And so, right. So that's what's the minimum structure that we want governments to have. I think that that's kind of a really, that's the starting point for that. And then once we agree on that, we say, okay, we are not willing to, you know, give, we think that this should be part of the, of our commons, and should be public and accessible by anyone. This is our commons. Then what kind of services we can kind of access from different providers, right? And I think that that's, that might be the way, you know, one of the possible outcomes that, you know, how we organize ourselves as a society in the future. I would say that that would be one of the good ones, right? In you know, always with every, we are in absolute turmoil at the moment, and we don't really know how the coin is gonna end up dropping. And so I would say that that's one of the kind of positive outcomes. Like, if that happens, I would be happy to be living in this world. Maybe that's where we're going, maybe not. But I think that's interesting. There's a really cool talk by Balaji about, called the networked state. And the argument is that as we grow, kind of as ourselves go digital, you know, we work remote, we have our money in our head, right, in a wallet or in a seed in our pocket. And we are able to kind of be much more nomads and you know, digital nomads and lead a nomadic life. We're more able to vote with our feet, essentially. So we can, now if we have, today we have enough organizational tools to be able to organize large number, like large number of people around the world. So if we can all agree that we're going to move into one place, or we're going to live in one place, then our bargaining power with the government of that place is like, it's huge, right? And I see that happening, like my, in a very small scale, but both Open Collective and Democracy Earth teams are 100% remote. So I work from wherever I am in the world, right? I don't care. And you know, we, of course, you have to be, you know, right now you have to be in a position of some privilege to be able to say, I'm going to pack up my life and move somewhere else. A, because we're able to move and we have the means, and also we have the freedom in, you know, or we have the ownership of our bodies to be able to do that. That's not the case for a whole chunk of the world, right? But as obviously this is not going to happen today, but I see that also as a way that our future societies are going to be developing. And so in that kind of scenario, a proposal like yours, where you can kind of buy into different providers from for different social goods, it's a much more achievable kind of scenario, I guess.
With the way that things are unfolding in the world and the direction that things are taking economically and politically, what kind of structures do you think would be really useful to test and implement it to deal with the problems that we're experiencing right now globally, like climate change and these kind of extremist governments taking hold because people are scared and they'll just vote for whoever seems to, you know, have the biggest fist?
Yeah. So I guess on climate change, I am very bullish on kind of liquid democracy and sovereign and these kind of structures where we can come together beyond what our governments are deciding or saying or doing, and kind of pledge together to take action on these items and then on these issues, and then actually doing it and figuring out ways to hold ourselves accountable for doing it. So I'm actually quite bullish on that. There's a project that I can't talk a lot about, but that is thinking about how we can. They want to enable between, I don't know, 300 million people, young people around the world, to make together a decision on the execution on a certain budget. And the goal there is to create a network of people, of young people who are already organized, who have been able to collaborate on executing a budget. And then the aspiration is that once that network has been tested and once those budgets have been executed and those projects have been funding, we will have already created a network that can act and be deployed or self-deploy itself in different scenarios. Just imagine the sheer, you know, 300 million people acting together to not, you know, to execute on a budget and make a decision. And then that network has been created. And then it's like unlearning how to read, right? So once you've done that, once you're there, once you realize that 300 million people can collaborate at that scale, kind of the impact of that for, like the aspiration is that then that's going to be a network and it's going to, you know, grow into having impact on different areas. And climate change is a super, super clear one for me. Like it's definitely the one that, if of all the issues in the world, I think that climate change is the one where we can all come together as peers that share a common planet. Like it's the one issue that affects us, you know, all in that kind of very deep level. I am very, you know, I'm very interested in that experiment and other experiments like that. Because what we need to create are those networks, right? What we need to create is that collaboration at scale that before was only able to be organized under a government or under a nation state. And now for the first time, we have the technology to do it away from those structures, right? Away from those frameworks. And I don't know, I've always been super optimist and a bit naive, but I think that the possibilities of this are endless. Are, you know, what we can do if we are able to organize 300 million people to decide on a budget, what we can do after that, it's incredible. So, yeah, that I'm hopeful. I guess, because of projects like that.
That's such a cool project idea too. And you can directly right? measure the efficiency of it against, you know, other traditional ways of doing
it. It's insane. Like, mm-hmm. it's crazy. Like, if that actually kind of takes place in that way, yeah. and again, those are the kind of projects that we need to be thinking of, because we need to create these networks. Like, seriously, for the first time, we're able to organize human collaboration at that scale. Like, it's insane that we're not using it. And so those are the structures that we need to create to cope with the problems that we have today. Obviously, I don't have the solutions to anything. I just have, you know, I guess we're asking ourselves the right questions, and at least we are experimenting.
Last couple of questions here. So what, from your experience, what are the most interesting projects or the kind of things that are coming out now, technologies or groups or projects that are most exciting and most promising to you right now?
Well, I mean, what I just mentioned is clearly one of them. Just because it's in my head, but my conversation with Kiva yesterday and their SSI self-sovereign identity proposal, I think it's like fantastic and really, really interesting. Then at city level, I would definitely follow Madrid, Barcelona. Right now, it's very interesting what they're doing. South Australia is very interesting what they're doing. And then on more like specific tech projects, all projects that are working with kind of social credit score records are very, very interesting. Projects that are working with how we do identity in a peer-to-peer way. Projects that are making tech, like Casanode, for example, that are trying to make kind of the management of private keys into something that is actually doable by anyone, as opposed to having four seats written down somewhere that you don't even remember, and the, you know, the drama of managing your private keys. There's a huge gap there. What Democracy Earth at least is doing in Venezuela, I think, is very interesting, because the work is a very social work, but to scale. To help scale kind of crypto projects in Venezuela, to help them obviously with being able not only to leave the country, but actually to leave the country with some currency, some form of currency that's worth something somewhere in the world. And so the, you know, we are working with actually, there's a huge gap between those who are thinking and building in this, like, you know, decentralized space or web three space, and what's actually happening in third world countries. And so it's, you know, there's a lot of translation needed, and like actual translation from English to other languages, but also translation in how those technologies are usable and adaptable. So all the projects that are doing that are kind of super interesting, and I think they're very valuable today. So that's kind of the what I'm looking at in the space, obviously.
What are some of your favorite books or resources for learning more about democracy and where it could go in the future?
All right. So I mentioned Balaji's Network State talk. I think it's worth the Network State. I think it's worth Googling it or DuckDuckGoing it or whatever. I prefer DuckDuckGo, but they don't have a verb. Unfortunately, they didn't think that name through very well. I love them and I use them. I don't use you, Google, but you know, missed the verb there.
Yeah, they missed the verb. That's right.
Right?
Just duck, duck, go it. What?
Duck, duck, no. Go it. Yeah, I'm gonna start that. something more like oldie, but I think it's still super relevant is and it's one of my favorite books, Benedict Anderson, Imagined Communities. It tells the story about how the nation states came about. And I think that that's key for anyone who's thinking about where democracy is going to go, because whenever, like, it's really useful whenever a paradigm is kind of declining, to understand how it came about and to start seeing the signals in the current, in today, that are marking a new paradigm, right? Because history tends to flow in patterns too. So Benedict Anderson, Imagine Communities, super, super interesting. Then from Jim Fishkin, Deliberation Day, I think is the name. So Deliberative Democracy. I think that, so when Fishkin and Ackerman proposed this in the 80s, technology wasn't what it is today. So there was clearly a scalability problem to what they were proposing, but that changed today. So actually that book kind of regained popularity today with the kind of technology that we have today. And I think that deliberation is a key aspect of democracy, and we cannot think of democracy just as voting. Democracy is much more than just voting. And so that book is very helpful to inform that kind of what else is democracy, right? So deliberation is a key aspect of that. What else I read a lot? Then on power, I would read amazing book, Jeremy Rifkin, the
Zero Marginal Cost Society,
The Age of Empathy.
Ah, I haven't read that one yet.
Yeah, fascinating.
Cool.
Go for it. Like it's like really, really good. It kind of I think it's a book that it's seriously underrated. It goes through how the different kind of tectonic shifts in how we govern ourselves in history happened. And his argument is that it was this combination of a new energy policy, so a new way of harnessing energy and a new communication technology, and how that was what produced like a whole new era. So I see distributed generation of energy and the kind of internet and communication technologies as the kind of markers of our era that are going to usher in a new, and he calls it the age of empathy. Really, really good book. I highly recommend that. It was a pleasure to read. So that's kind of, I can send some more if you're going to publish this online, but out of the top of my head, those are like great books.
Cool.
Very cool. Great.
Any other questions from you?
Well, we're running out of time. You probably have to go. So we can wrap up here. Yeah. Thank you so much for joining us. This is a fascinating conversation. Very interesting things that you're working on.
Cool. Thank you for having me. And just let me know if I can, do anything else or share more resources if you're going to publish online or something. I'm happy to come up with some more resources too.
Cool. Thanks a lot. Take care.
Thank you.
This episode is brought to you by Qualia, a nootropic supplement that helps support mental performance and mood. To get 10% off, use the code FUTURE at checkout. And to learn more about neurohacking, visit futurethinkers.org/neuro.
Thanks for tuning in to Future Thinkers. For all the books, resources, and mentions from this episode, go to futurethinkers.org/70. Don't forget to subscribe and hit the bell icon to get notified of new videos. You can also follow us on social media to stay connected. If you'd like to get a t-shirt like the new Make America Think Again, go to futurethinkers.org/store. If you like what we do and you want to help us make more podcasts and videos, consider donating or becoming a patron at futurethinkers.org/support. Also visit our sponsor Qualia and use the coupon code FUTURE to get 10% off your purchase.